Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're tonight's entertainment.
Look at my butt. Now look at my front butt.
Wada, 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 wada.
Open the circuit to the wave motion gun. Open the circuit.
Let the chamber pressure increase.
All the ship's energy is now in the wave motion gun.
I doubt anyone here would recognize civic virtue if it reached up and bit you in the ass.
Oh, did I hurt your feelings?
Blue Magneto's right. There's a war coming. You sure you're on the right side?
And, well, let's just say to start off, Sunday's show really bit all three of us in the ass. And, yes, the usual crew is here of Carl Kafer and Doc Sledge. Say hi, everyone.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
And we're doing a Romero show on Sunday. That would have been bad enough that we got Romero's death about 20 minutes before we went on the air, guys.
About an hour.
About an hour, yeah.
Then about 10 minutes before we went off the air, we got the news that Martin Landau had died. If you listen to the end of that show, you'll hear Doc basically telling us.
Yeah, it was a rough Sunday. That is
to say the least.
Martin Landau, for what you young people who don't bother to look at your damn past don't know, he was always in big stuff. I mean, he started out on television, appearing on a lot of big series before he got his first starring role. Well, yeah, I call it starring because pretty much all five of those guys were stars of the show, right, Carl?
That's true, but it was an ensemble piece for sure.
Yeah. And that would be Mission Impossible. How many years was he on Mission Impossible, Carl?
He was on there for four out of the 6 years. And I was telling you this earlier, but the interesting thing is that Leonard Nimoy was up for Star Trek, and so was Martin Landau. And actually, Martin Landau turned it down, so Nimoy got Star Trek, and then Landau got Mission Impossible. Well, Landau left because of contract negotiations, and they weren't going to give him enough money, so he left. Star Trek was over, and guess who took over Landau's spot for the last two seasons? Any guesses?
Leonard
would be
Nimoy.
Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah, he was good. I do understand why he left, because Peter Graves was the only member of that cast that was getting any royalty off all the toys and all the books and stuff that were using their pictures.
Right. And don't forget the other thing, too, is his wife was on the show. You know, he was married to Barbara Bain at the time. And they both left the show at the same time. He left and went to go on and do other things. And we'll be talking about that.
Yeah.
Very good.
And what's sad is he wasn't the lowest paid on the stool. The lowest paid one on the show was, do we want to get into that kind of racial politics?
Not right now, but Greg was the lowest paid.
And that was another reason Landau left. He was always a man of integrity.
Mm-hmm. You know, and the thing about Martin, you know, as you look at Mission Impossible and then his work on Space 1999, which is later, you know, he comes off as a capable actor, you know, who's a good TV actor. There were a couple of roles that he had in films. He had a small role in The Hallelujah Trail. Did in the Spaghetti Western. I'll let you talk about that because I don't know it that well. But yeah, I mean, the other thing, too, is his TV work before Mission Impossible. We have to talk about, he did two episodes each of Twilight Zone and Outer Limits. And the Outer Limits, particularly the Bolero Shield, is friggin' awesome. And he's great at it. What?
What,
Steven?
He did the trifecta.
Trifecta?
Yeah.
Okay. Twilight Zone, Outer Limits,
Alfred
and what was the other one? Okay,
Alfred
he did
Hitchcock
Alfred Hitchcock,
presents.
Too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he also did a lot of Playhouse 90, all of the play shows that were in the 50s that... Sadly,
yeah, Craft Theater and all those, Playhouse 90, Craft Theater, and there was another one that I can't remember right now.
Yeah. Blue Bonnet.
Right, okay, thank you.
Blue Bonnet Presents.
Now, there's something else I want to talk about, too, which I don't know if you realize, and then I thought about it, and I said, yeah, he was in one of those. He was actually in a blaxploitation film as the villain.
Really?
Which one?
Yes. Black Gun.
I said which one?
Black Gun.
Black. Oh, yeah. I know what his black
Black
is.
Okay. But Black Gun, G-U-N-N.
Yeah.
And,
like I said, I know another re-release title once Kung Fu... got big, and because he was sort of a street fighter in it, it was retitled Black Fist.
Okay. Well, I noticed Black Gun, and that was one of the films that I saw on HBO when we had the early HBO incantation, like 73, and they ran all the blaxploitation stuff. And I'd forgotten about that. I checked his IMDb, and I said, right, he was in that. So that was cool.
And let me talk about the Spaghetti Western a little bit. Let me get a little information up for it. Sorry.
And also, he actually further on in his career, he was in a very awesome little horror movie called Without Warning.
I've got that.
I tried to get Raiden Clark, but he shut down his messages.
Now, we tried to get in touch with Graydon to see if he would want to come on. He was also in a film, since we're talking about that, there's a trifecta of films in the 80s. One is Without Warning. The other one is Jackie Kong's The Being. And then one of my favorites, and I'd forgotten about this, and then I checked out some YouTube things of it today, and that's Fred Olen Ray's Cyclone. He plays the bad guy in Cyclone. He's great.
Okay, I've got it. A Town Called Hell, which was just called on its trailer and DVD, has another title. You know, would you think that with a name called A Town Called Hell, they could not make it any worse?
Well, they could. Probably.
Yes, the original title of this, and this is the UK Spanish co-production, is A Town Called Bastard.
A Town Called what?
Bastard. Yeah.
Nice.
It's about Stella Stevens as a vengeful widow who rides around in a coach in a coffin, presided over by a priest and a sadistic Mexican outlaw played by Telly Savalas. And the priest is a Mexican rebel played by Robert Shaw. And Martin Landau shows up to find Robert Shaw's character. Just listen
okay.
to this list. Robert Shaw as the priest slash bandit leader. Kelly Savalas as Don Carlos. Stella Stevens as Olivia. Martin Landau as the colonel. Fernando Rey as a blind man. Alla Terry as La Bomba. I wonder what his character's speciality
Alla Terry? Then I gotta watch this.
Yeah.
I am the king of Alla Terry fan club. I love that guy.
Off the wall.
Michael Craig is Paco.
Just Taco.
Taco, T-A-C-L.
No, I like Taco better.
This is a very, very, very bizarre film.
Sounds like it. And it sounds really fun,
and
too.
It is really fun. And Landau was great in it. I don't know why everyone else is appearing in it, but this really is his only one. That he did spaghetti westerns.
Mhm. Yeah, he did a lot of TV during that period. Like after Mission Impossible, he was on several shows, and he'd be a journeyman actor, special guest, but it wasn't really until the late 80s, early 90s, where he started to kick in as a really go-to guy for a supporting actor. And that's where I think all of us truly love his work.
Oh, yeah. I'll be honest with you. One of the weirdest but also awesome horror films from the 80s that it popped right in my head. It's basically about this mutated. It's about this kid who gets mutated into a giant watermelon-headed monster thing, and it's called the Bean.
You mean the Bean?
Yeah, it's
absolutely. Oh, it's
getting,
wonderful.
Blu-ray soon.
Oh, it is. I got the original release.
In fact, we should reach out to Jackie and see if she wants to come on our show. She'd be a great guest.
Are you
talking about Jackie Fox? Right now she's busy as hell with all of the with the blood feast tour going around.
Okay.
Well, reach out to her again because it'd be a great thing to have her on. And particularly to have a female director of exploitation and horror. Because
yes.
We need to do that. Absolutely.
Yes, Jesus, thank you. That would be fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love The Bean. I had mentioned that. You had mentioned Without Warning, and then there's The Bean, and then there's Cyclone, which is Fred Olen Ray's motorcycle movie with Jeffrey Combs.
Oh. Hello.
Neep.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
Is Steve?
Hello.
I can hear you.
Yeah, we can definitely hear you.
Jack.
Is this Jack?
Yeah, it's me.
Okay.
This is
introduce our guest, Stephen.
Yeah, this is our guest.
Jack Shoulder.
Jack Shoulder,
yes,
yeah. He had
Steven?
The look of his first film. Did you realize at the start how great a cast you had lined up for that movie?
Yes. Well, the one I was most excited about was actually Donald Pleasence, who I thought was one of the greatest actors in the world. Palance seemed good, and Landau seemed good, and Landau actually solicited us to be in the film, which just goes to show how slow his career was at that point, that when his agent called us up, but it was fantastic. And I don't know whether you saw my Facebook page, but I have a picture of myself and Landau, Palance, Bob Shea, the head of New Line, and Erlen Van Litt, and three of those people ended up getting Academy Awards, you know, 20-some years later. So it was a pretty amazing
and
cast.
Van Litt
yeah.
should have had a better career than he had.
Well, he died young. I mean, he died, I think, in his 30s. He was a giant of a man. He was like, I don't know, he was like 6'8 and weighed, you know, well over 300 pounds. His hand was like a baseball mitt. I mean, you'd shake hands with him and your hand would just disappear into his hand. You know, he wasn't the greatest actor, but he was an amazing guy, and he actually did a great job in the film.
Oh, and
so of course, the film we're
talking about, we're talking about Alone in the Dark, 1981.
Right.
So Jack, that was your first film, right? Alone in the Dark
was
your first film?
That was my first feature, yeah. That was my first feature.
So how did you get hooked up with New Line and Bob Shea? How did that all work out?
Well, I met Bob Shea in 1969. I'd made some shorts in college. I mean, I was an English major. I didn't have any film in my college, but I made some short films anyway. And I had a friend of mine whose girlfriend was working as a temp over there, and he just started the company. You know, he had four people working there. They were in an office above a bar. And so he said, my friend said, well, why don't you show him some of your movies? Maybe he'll want to distribute them. So I dropped them off and dropped off a couple. You know, they were shorts, and called me back a week or two later and said, you know, why don't you come down? And said he liked the films, but you know, but there really wasn't much money in distributing shorts, and he had all that he needed. And did I know anybody who could cut a trailer? And I said, yeah, me. So, you know, and I had graduated from college, I don't know, you know, 6 months earlier, and I picked up some work editing. So I edited a trailer for him, and we basically locked ourselves in somebody else's editing room over the weekend when they weren't there and edited this trailer. And by the end of the weekend, we were friends. So after that, I, whenever they had a trailer or they had a movie that they wanted to recut or anything else, I would always do it, you know. Plus, I became very close friends with Bob Shea. You know, we'd go out 2-3 nights a week. And so, so somewhere around 1979, 1980, when I don't know when did Halloween, but the Friday the 13th, I think, came out in, what, 79 or 80 or something like that.
Halloween is 79, and
Friday the 13th
is 80, isn't it? Yeah.
A little bit above.
A little bit later.
They started
it's around there,
some sneak screenings in 79, but then released it wide in 80.
Because I remember going to see Friday the 13th with Shea. And, you know, Shea was in awe because, you know, here they'd made this low-budget horror film, and it was just cleaning up. And New Line, at that point, mainly their business was film distribution. They did not produce films. They acquired films. And Most of their market, or what they specialized in, was what was then called the youth market, but, you know, booking films in colleges and stuff like that. So they said, well, gee, you know, we really know this audience. If we could make a low-budget horror film, we could clean up. So I came up with this idea for Alone in the Dark. And a year and a half later, we actually made it. I mean, it wasn't exactly the idea that you see in the end, but it was pretty much that idea. So that's how it happened. And then after that, they did Elm Street with Wes. And then, when it came time to do Elm Street 2, Wes wasn't interested, and they asked me, and I did it. And the rest is history. So there you go.
Yeah, I've always loved New Line. for, you know, for the horror movies. And for, like, my first in line cinema movie that I ever saw was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So I associated, that time, I associated awesome with New Line Cinema. So that's very cool.
Right. where are you
let's
guys?
Let's talk
based?
A little bit about. Okay, never mind. Go ahead, Jack. Sorry.
No, I was just asking where you guys are based.
I'm south of Rochester, New York.
And I'm in Plainfield, New Jersey, North Plainfield, New Jersey. And Stephen, tell them where you are.
I'm in Tennessee.
Oh, okay. That's what I thought.
I'm one of them country folks.
Well, I'm just down the road from you. I'm in Asheville.
Oh, cool.
Not too far. Yeah.
And I
want to
say that you did the anti-slasher movie with Alone in the Dark.
Well, that was kind of what I was trying to do. I mean, people call it a slasher movie, but I don't really think of it that way. It was more about other stuff, and then sort of the slashing part was like my price of admission, you know, in order to get to make the film.
So tell us a little bit about
pretty quirky film.
So tell us a little bit about your relationship with Martin and what you thought of him as you were filming and that sort of thing. Give us a couple of stories.
Well, as I said, the first person we cast, I think, was Palance. The producer said, you know, what would you think of the role of getting Palance to play that part? And I said, wow, that would be fantastic. You know, I'd remembered him from Shane, you know, where he was like, you know, the baddest bad guy in Westerns ever, you know.
Right. Pick up the gun.
Yeah, and also, I mean, he was in Requiem for a Heavyweight, where I think he won an Emmy. I mean, he was a great actor, and so I was thrilled about that. Landau was the last one to come in, and so I shot the first day, and I wasn't that nervous, you know, like a lot of people, oh, it's their first day on the first film, they're really nervous. I wasn't that nervous, and we shot, we had this, and I didn't quite get everything that I wanted to get or everything that I was supposed to get. And at the end of the day, Bob Shea showed up on the set. We were shooting somewhere out in New Jersey, in Bergen County. Is Plainfield's not in Bergen County, is it?
No. We're south of Bergen County.
Right. You're in Essex?
Yeah, we're in Essex. You got it.
Yeah. Yeah. So we were shooting north of there, somewhere out in the middle of nowhere. And Shay comes up to me and he says, Jack Palance is in town. I had lunch with him today and he's really pissed off because they told him there wouldn't be any night shooting. I mean, this is a film called Alone in the Dark. And, oh, don't worry, Jack, no night shooting. And he was supposed to, after he agreed to do our film, he had been offered another film that was going to shoot in Florence, Italy. And we told him that we'd sue him if he took that film. So he was pretty pissed off about that. I mean, where would you rather be, Florence, Italy, or Bergen County, New Jersey, you know, in the middle of the night? So he was, and so Bob said, and he's really pissed off. He's angry, and we were walking down the street, and somebody said, are you Jack Palance? And he almost punched the guy in the mouth. And
oh, dear.
So I had an anxiety attack. I mean, right then and there. I mean, I just kind of panicked. And he said, oh, and by the way, Martin Landau is also in town, and he wants to have dinner with you. So I said, I don't know. And he said, no, you got to have dinner with him. We already told him that you're going to have dinner, you know, and if you don't have dinner with him, he's going to be really pissed off. So I said, all right. So the first thing I did was I went into a liquor store and bought like a fifth of bourbon and got into a cab and started drinking it to try to calm myself down. And Landau was waiting in the restaurant of the hotel he was staying in with his wife, Barbara Bain. And he, you know, he was a really nice guy, but I was like, you know, I was like, you know, like I said, I was in the midst of a, like an anxiety attack, so I wasn't the best company. I actually remembered that I ordered consomme for dinner. I thought it was the only thing I could possibly keep down, you know. And he said, "Oh yeah, I worked in the past with Jack. Yeah, Jack's kind of a crazy guy." You know, when I had told him what Shay told me, and he said, "Yeah, Jack and I were in a movie with Harry Guardino's brother. Harry Guardino was another kind of actor from that from the 50s." And he said there was a scene
familiar.
Yeah, so he said there was a scene in the film where Jack Palance is playing the heavy, and he's supposed to crack Guardino on the head with a lead pipe. So when it comes time to do the scene, the prop guy gives Palance a fake pipe, and Palance says, "You know what's this?" And he said, "Well, it's a fake pipe." And he said, "Well, I'm not going to hit the guy. You know, I'm just going to swing it, and he's going to like act like I hit him, and that's how we always do it. And I need a real pipe in order for me to act correctly in this scene." And he said, "Well, you know, what if you actually miss and you actually hit the guy?" He said, "No, I'm not going to do that." So he said, "Well, you know, if Guardino says it's okay," so they ask Guardino, he says it's okay. So they do take one, and he cracks the guy's head open. So that, of course, made me feel really good. And that was the end of the evening. And then the next day, you know, Landau and Palance were there. Actually, Landau didn't work until, I think, the following day. But so I met Palance, and he kind of gave me a hard time, and then we sort of made our peace, and I mean I was amazingly lucky to get to work with him because I learned a lot. I mean he was quite a character, but Landau he kind of knew that it was a very tough shoot. You know, there wasn't enough money and they didn't hire the best crew people, and you know, nothing was, you know, I didn't have all the kind of help that you would normally have, you know, surrounded by a lot of people, you know, who knew much more than I did, who could kind of help me along. And we were mostly shooting nights, and, you know, sometimes Palance would be a little bit difficult. And so Marty would always kind of stand up for me, and he'd always come on the set, and when I'd see him, he'd walk over to me and say, "Hey, how are you, kiddo? How you doing, kiddo?" And he'd sort of, like, you know, give me a little back massage, you know, for about a minute. You know, say, "How's it going, kid? It's going to be okay, kiddo." He would call me kiddo. And so that was kind of what he was like. And I remember there was have you seen Alone in the Dark?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I own it.
there's that scene where the three guys, he and Landau and Erland, are all lying in bed, and they're plotting about that they're going to get out when the time is right, and they're all just lying in bed, kind of like three peas in a pod, and I also wrote the film. So when I wrote the film, you know, I had this clear idea of these three guys just lying in bed in a row, like three peas in a pod, plotting this thing. So when it came time to shoot the scene, Palance said that he didn't want to lie in bed. He wanted to get up. He felt that he should be getting up and walking around, or at least sitting up, not lying down. And I said, "Well, Jack, it's really kind of the way I always pictured it, you know." And then he said that wasn't a very good way to shoot it. It wasn't a good idea. And I wasn't ready to give up on it. And Landau said, "Ah, why don't you just do what the kid says?" And Palance said, "Oh, all right. You know, finally agreed." And actually, a few weeks later, we were having a horrendous night. The the riot in the shopping center, basically just everything went wrong, and it was in terms of a shoot, a disaster. I'd been up for about 20 hours straight the night before. I got about 3 hours of sleep, and I was really just in a bad way, and I went to Palance and Landau and Erwin, and I said, guys, you know, I had this one idea of how we could save the scene, and I was just going to use this extra to do this thing, and I actually forget what it was, and I found out that they'd sent the extra home because they wanted to save money. And I said, and my brain just kind of crashed, and I said, I'm not quite sure what to do, so just hang on, you know, I'm going to have to figure something out, but right now I just don't know what the hell to do. And as I was walking out of the room, Palance said, hey, Jack. I said, yeah. He said, remember the other night when we argued about how to shoot the scene in the bed? I said, yeah. Mm-hmm. He said, and Palin said, you know what? You were right. And then just kind of walked away from me, you know? So he was a cool guy, you know?
Nice.
Landau always was, he was a little bit pissed off at Bob Shea. Like, I think they had some argument about how he was getting paid or, you know, something or other, but he was always nice to me, always a gentleman. And when I went out to L.A. for the first time, I don't know, a year later or so, I got in touch with him, and we met, and we had dinner, and we chatted, and from that point on, we kind of stayed in touch. And I'd always the hardest part of the whole directing job for me was working with actors, and I had studied acting. I mean, not to be an actor, but to be a better director. But I had, you know, studied acting with, you know, two or three different acting teachers, and I'd done a little bit of theater and stuff like that. But I just always felt that working with actors was the hardest part of making movies, because, you know, I was an editor, and I had a very good sense of where to put the camera. You know, I had a good sense of how to stage a scene, but the actor thing was always tricky. And so Marty sort of became my mentor. And after a particularly unfortunate experience with an actor in one of my films, he got me into the Actor's Studio, of which he was the head, to audit. And so for 6 months, I just see these actors working with each other, and I learned an enormous amount. And he would give me good advice. I remember once I was doing a film, and my lead actress just made these terrible, terrible choices. She always liked, if there were three possible choices, she would pick the worst. And got all these ideas about how to do her part that I just thought were terrible. And so every time she would want to do something, I'd have to say, well, you know, let's do it this way, you know, instead. And after two or three days of this, I got worried that I was going to lose her, you know, because every time she wanted to do something, I would shut her down. And so I called up Landau, and I explained it to him, and I said, how should I handle this? I'm afraid that I'm going to lose this actress, because I'm always telling her that I don't like what she's doing. So he said, well, what do you say when she comes up with something that you don't like? And I said, well, I would say, well, that was pretty interesting, but let's try it this way instead. So he said, don't say but, say now. You see the difference? But, I mean, when you say but, it means I didn't like your suggestion. When you say now, it means your suggestion's good. Now let's keep going from there. You know what I mean? It was just an incredibly insightful comment. And one other story I can tell you. When we did By Dawn's Early Light, he plays the president of the United States when Russia launches a nuclear attack against Washington. And we think he's dead, and then he turns up. He was in a helicopter trying to get out of Washington, and helicopter crash, but it turns out that he's survived the crash and he's in a FEMA shelter. And we were doing the scene and there was something missing from the scene. It just wasn't quite right. And I was trying to think of what to say. And I said that, you know, Marty, both your legs are broken. And he looked at me and said, Oh, okay. Right. And boom, the next take, you could just see the pain. And I mean, he was just a master of his craft, you know, just instantaneously, he just incorporated that and bang, it was there, you know? And he coached, you know, a lot of great actors, you know, Jack Nicholson. I mean, a lot of really great actors studied with him. He was friends with James Stewart. I mean, he was the man who fell off of Mount Rushmore in North by Northwest. So having lunch with him one day put me, you know, one degree of separation from Alfred Hitchcock and a whole lot of other, you know, great people in the film industry. So it was a great thing to have him in my film, but it was even a greater thing to have him as a friend. And, you know, I did two more films with him, you know, whenever there was a role that I thought that would fit him, that was suitable for him to play, I'd ask him to do it just so I could work with him again. I moved out of Hollywood 13 years ago to start a film program at a university in North Carolina. And we spoke several times. You know, I tried to get him to come out, but he was always too busy. He was doing this film or that film or whatever. I mean, well into his 80s, you know, he was full of life and full of ideas and full of enthusiasm. And he was a really wonderful man. Always bragged about his kids. One of his daughters is an actress, and he's always bragging about what a terrific actress she was. And, you know, he was kind of a family guy.
Whoever just called in, I'm sorry I had you on hold for so long. I didn't see it on the board.
Oh, well, not a problem. Anyway,
that was me, probably, because I got kicked off, and then I was able to get back on.
Uh-huh.
No, this one. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Did you get all that?
Jack, the one movie you were talking about since I got kicked off, that was 1201?
Yeah, 1201. I did three. I mean, I did Alone in the Dark, and then I did By Dawn's Early Light. And then the third one I did was 1201.
Right. I love 1201.
Actually, they're all 1201 is really one of my, out of the 15 films that I've done, it's, you know, it's definitely probably in the top three. It's a favorite of mine, and it's a really good script, and you know, Landau was perfect for that role.
Absolutely. We want to thank you profusely for coming on and giving some personal thoughts on Martin. For me particularly, you know, I grew up in the 60s, so my first real introduction to him was Mission Impossible.
Right.
And then, of course, you know, being a sci-fi geek also, I love Space 1999.
Right.
And, you know, being a fan and of course, not knowing him and that sort of thing, you still are so impressed with the work that he did over the years. And I'm just so glad that later in life, you know, he got a chance to really shine in some of his later films. Of course,
well,
he was Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, it was great because, I remember when he was doing what's the film about the car inventor with Coppola and Tucker. Tucker.
No, Tucker, the man in his dream.
Right.
Yeah. So actually what happened was, you know, he and I stayed in touch, and then one day he got Tucker. So that was like a huge thing for him, you know, because here he was working, you know, with a world-class director again, and you know, in a big movie, and I think that that kind of then led to and he got an Academy Award for that role. Academy Award nomination, sorry. He got nominated for Best Actor for that role. And then 2 or 3 years later, he won it for doing Bela Lugosi.
Yeah, for me, Tucker is just amazing. We have a couple clips that we'll play at the end of the show.
Yeah.
And
one is from Tucker.
The one I picked was Tucker.
And the one his final speech. The one I picked is his final speech from Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Oh, he was fantastic in that. He was wonderful in that film. Yeah. Well,
don't ever say you went to work for a world-class director. You were good. You're good, Jack. I mean, Alone in the Dark, what? I love. I remember seeing it, Dawn's Early Light, and that one's good. The Hidden.
Well, even if I were a world-class director, I wouldn't say so. But it's nice of you to say so. I mean, Marty, he was a really fine professional actor and a really quality human being. So, you know, what more can you ask for, you know? And he had just a deep amount of experience. I mean, he was, you know, he knew more about acting than just about anybody. I mean, you know, he worked with Strasberg. He was friends with James Dean and, you know, all those guys. And, you know, he's part of that whole crowd. Another kind of interesting little thing was that he actually started out as an illustrator. That he was
I read that, actually.
I think he might have been a cartoonist or something like that. But
yeah, cartoonist,
but initially,
is what I...
Yeah, initially he had started out, I mean, his first career was as an illustrator. I never saw any of his illustrations, but I mean, that, you know, that was how he kind of got started. So yeah, so those are my stories about working with Landau.
Yeah.
Very awesome. We really appreciate all your stories. Thank you.
Yeah. Well,
we would love to get you just sometime just to talk on everything that you did when you have more time.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. We'll get in touch and we can set it up.
Awesome.
Okay.
But happy to do so. I'm actually going to be doing some screenings. I know that Friday the 13th, October, in Syracuse, they're doing a big Nightmare on Elm Street retrospective where they're going to show all the films in 35 millimeter. And I'm going up for that. And I know
that's what
I'm pretty sure. What?
You said Syracuse, New York, right?
Yeah.
That's an hour and a half away from where I live, so I can make that.
Oh, really? You should check it out. I think it's called the Freddy Fest or the Freddy something. But it's in Syracuse, and apparently I think it's a place called the Palace Theater or something. It's one of those
I've been there before.
Theaters.
It's gorgeous in there. Trust me, you'll love it.
Right, and he asked me to show a couple of episodes that I did for TV at an IMAX. Believe it or not, one is a Tales from the Crypt that I did I've always had a fond spot for that. It's really, really pretty funny. And another thing that I did for HBO called Vietnam War Stories. It was kind of a little more on the serious side, about a group of sergeants who want to. Yeah, it was a great show. It was a fantastic show. So I was very happy to be a part of that. So I'm going to be screening those. And then I think the end of October, I think I'm going out to Omaha, someplace I've never been, to screen something else. And so, yeah, so, you know, it'd be great if you came out to Syracuse and said hi in person.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, maybe we could even, you know, if you want to do an interview for the podcast, then maybe, you know, you could work it out. There's a guy called Jeff Myers. You know Jeff Meyer?
I don't personally know.
Yeah. Well, he's the guy who runs it. But if you wanted to check it out, let me see here. Jeff Meyer. Let's see here. Yeah, it's called the Freddy Fest.
Freddy Fest. Okay. I will make notes and hop on over and take a look.
And I just put it down for you too, Doc. So. I'll message
down,
that to
Carl.
You.
I told you about that. I was putting Carl stuff down. Good Lord.
Hey, I'm the
one that takes notes.
Uh-huh.
Well, good. All right. Well, listen. Maybe I'll see you in Syracuse.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. I'll be coming back to get out there.
Yeah, check it out.
You know what? I could request a day off and say, because my birthday is on October 10th. I'm taking off Friday 13th off. Aha, there you go.
Okay. Good. All right. Well, listen, thanks for having me on the show.
You're more than welcome. Thank you for coming, Jack.
Glad to have a chance to say a few words about my dear friend, Marty, who we will all miss. Okay. Talk to you later.
Okay. Thanks, Jack. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay,
that
we're definitely
awesome.
Going to be going over.
That was awesome, guys.
Wouldn't you say, Carl?
Seriously.
Yeah, I think we'll go over a little bit. We should play those two clips, though, to end it up.
Yeah, we're going
to
get into but, yeah, to really start, it really was. Once he got Tucker, good God, did the ball start running. After that, it wasn't if he was going to win an Oscar, it was when. Me and Carl had a fight of which role he should have won. I was like, he should have won for Crimes and Misdemeanors. He should have won for Tucker. Yeah, but
he won for
Ed
White, which he should have won too.
Yeah.
You know? There's a couple other movies I want to just mention very briefly that we didn't mention.
Wait, we're going to play the clip, so set up the Tucker clip for us, so we're going to play that right
now. Before we do, I just want to do two films that he was in very briefly. One is The Majestic. The Majestic is a flawed film, but if you see that movie and you see his work in it, he's absolutely fantastic. And another one I love, and it's an animated film called Nine, and he plays Number Two, which is sort of the mentor role to Elijah Wood, who plays Number One, or Number Six, I think. But, you want to check that out.
He looks like a robot, doesn't he?
What?
I'm sorry. Whenever I hear Number Two, there's one thing that pops in my mind first. I'm sorry, Carl.
Okay. Well, that's when I eat cheese and then have coffee. I've only had coffee, so there's no Number Two.
Okay.
Okay.
But,
now,
yeah,
Tucker.
Now set up the clip.
Okay. So Jeff Bridges plays Preston Tucker, who has this idea of cars that he wants to make. And he is there's a politician against him that's played by Lloyd Bridges. And Martin Landau plays this lawyer that works with Preston Tucker, who's played by Jeff Bridges. And this is at the end of the movie when they know that they've lost, that there won't be Tucker's maid. And there's this scene between Jeff Bridges and Martin Landau, and that's all I need to say. Go ahead. play the clip.
Is that it? Captains are now with the ships. Not businessmen.
Look me in the eyes. Too good a salesman, Abe, not to look a customer in the eyes.
What do you think? I'm playing games here? What do you
think?
Yeah,
I think you're trying to. You're trying some double whammy kind of hustle backwards. Why?
You gotta make me say it.
Yeah, let's start from there. Because of this little piece of paper, they're not going to? Just leave me alone, will you? The whole 10 years since I've been independent never bothered me for 2 seconds. I'm an ex-con. Why should it? Who cared? But for you and Vera, the kids to know, I'm ashamed. When I was a little kid, maybe 5 years old in the old country, my mother used to say to me, she'd warn me, she'd say, don't get too close to people. You'll catch their dreams. Years later, I realized I misunderstood her. Germs, she said, not dreams, you'll catch their germs. I want you to know something, Tucker. I went into business with you for one reason, to make money. That's all. How was I to know? That if I got too close, I'd catch your dreams.
Now, if that doesn't put a tingle up your spine, I don't think anything will.
Let me say something real quick, Carl. Tucker is weird because it's the only movie that stopped where it did because they wanted to give it a somber ending.
Mm-hmm. But even at the end of that, okay, so he says, I got this idea, and that's how it ends. He's talking to his family in the car. You know what that idea was?
What?
He started Coleman.
Yeah. But stop forgetting, the movie never mentions that he had the patents on all of his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So he ended up suing the car companies again for infringing on his patents. And guess what?
He won. I know.
He won. Every time the seatbelt or lights or anything like that, his family gets like 10 cents off of them or something, you know.
Yeah. But he also started Coleman, and so he made his money there, too. I mean,
yeah.
You know, the one reason that Coppola was so taken with him is that it is the American dream, and he didn't let this stuff stop him. You know, all the
chicanery. And Francis has one of the most, I don't know if he still has it, but back then he had one of the most valuable car collections in the world.
Including the Tucker.
Yeah, which there is only 20 known Tuckers left.
And that was at the time of the film, which is 30 years ago.
I knew a
and
gentleman.
And only 11 in good shape.
I knew, I literally knew a gentleman here in this town who owned an insurance company who had a Tucker. He had a Tucker, seriously. And
this
thing was in new condition. Unfortunately, this gentleman passed away with cancer, but his car collection took up an unbelievable amount of space. And he actually bought my Volkswagen thing from me, so I am eternally grateful to him. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nice.
And, Doc, do you know that when you do get a Tucker, it's easy to get mint replacement parts for it because that's how closely they stole from him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The parts, it's almost ridiculous.
But, you know, we're talking about the cars.
Yes.
So we're talking about the cars, but I want to get your thoughts on the clip that we just played.
It was chilling. I mean, I'm not familiar with, I don't know the whole history of Tucker. I just knew that he had, that someone had a car, but it's just like, okay, that's, I was very impressed by the acting in that scene. You could just feel, even without seeing it, you could feel the anger, you could feel the emotion coming from it. It's very impressive. Very impressive.
And you've seen the film, right? Right, Stephen? You've seen it.
Yeah.
So what's your thoughts on that clip?
Oh, it's a great clip, and it's a great little movie. It just amazes me still that they cut the movie short to give it a non-happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see that much.
No, but you know, again, it's a movie that I recommend highly, and it, for me, it's my favorite of his performances. And I love him in Crimes and Misdemeanors, and I love him in as Bela Lugosi. But this one just blew me away. I mean, I think it was the impact of seeing someone who I knew as an actor, and who I thought was a decent actor, just absolutely blow the place apart. I was just, I was literally with my jaw on the floor at the end of that film because of his performance. And I think that's why I love that performance so much, because it showed me what he could really do. So you got
like
one too that you picked.
88, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like 88, I think.
Yeah. That was the first of his nominations for Best Supporting Actor.
Mm-hmm. And he had three in a row.
Well, when you think of Woody Allen films, this is for both of you, do you think of like frothy movies, whimsical, white bread comedies and things like that?
Yeah, stuff like Sleeper and the rest, yeah.
You know, I mean, but I also know that he got very serious, you know, in the 80s and 90s, and he's still extremely prolific. So, you know, he's hit all different types of films. For me personally,
yeah, but
I was always more fond of his pre-1980 work, but that's me, you know. But there, you know, Crimes and Misdemeanors, Interiors, he did some outstanding work later in his career, which is more serious. And, of course, the clip that you're going to play
is
going to
go. My clip is probably going to be an overtime because we just got 90 seconds left. We're going to give all the sales spiel after that. But thank you for listening to the live part. The bonus section, which sometimes is always better, is coming up if you're listening to this as a recording.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you would never expect in 1989 that Woody Allen put out such an angry and bitter and just stone-coldly, bluntly truth about the world. Crimes and Misdemeanors is an intermingling story of a rich man who is having problems with his mistress who wants him to come out and tell his wife, but he's happy and comfy with the way things are. And Woody Allen, who plays a documentary filmmaker who's still trying to do the right thing and be the nice guy and talking shit, he's still got a little of the punk ethos in him.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you say, Carl, his character in that movie?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not the basic schlamozzle that he plays. He plays someone with a little more understanding what's going on.
Well, completely clueless.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how they keep interweaving these stories and they end up is that they're related to each other by marriage. And this is pretty much the end scene after everything's really went down, and Woody Allen's character pretty much has lost the girl because he's the nice guy. And Alan Alda's great in this, too, is the sleazy, rich director. Wouldn't you say, Carl?
Yes, absolutely.
And this is probably one you either just heard of and probably haven't seen. Have you, Doc?
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
Well, this is the end silk. It has a little, this is basically the thing that's wrapping it all up, and there's still the stuff in the middle with Alan Alda in it, but Martin Landau's speech right here is perfect. Here we go.
All by yourself, huh?
You're like me.
I always get sad at these kind of events.
You look very deep in thought.
I was plotting the perfect murder.
Yeah? Movie plot?
Movie?
Well, Ben, that's what Ben told me. He says you make films.
Yeah, but not that kind. You know, it's a different kind.
I have a great murder story.
Yes?
Great plot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hey, I've had too many to drink. I mean, forgive me. I know you want your privacy.
No, it's okay. I'm not doing anything special.
Except my murder story has a very strange twist.
Yeah.
Let's say there's this man who's very successful. He has everything.
Am I a phony?
Are you what?
Am I a phony?
What are you talking about? Are you a little high or something?
No, I'm... You know, I think he hates me.
Who hates you?
Your annoying husband. Every time I'm with him, I get tense, you know?
It's just that he's angry, you know that.
Well,
you know
at
that
what?
Now.
At what?
At what? Are you
yeah.
kidding me? He's got these fantasies about changing the world. He's a man who thinks he can change. So he makes
yeah.
these films and in the end they come to nothing. They're nothing.
Let me tell you something, Mike. He's got to grow up. I mean, this is the real world. This is the big time. They don't pay off on high aspirations. You got to deliver,
well,
you know?
Coming.
I mean, and not to mention the fact that, I mean, I can't believe it. You're still young. You're not getting the life that you deserve, you know?
Lester, I met somebody.
Oh. That is music to my ears.
Yeah.
And after the awful deed is done, he finds that he's plagued by deep-rooted guilt. Little sparks of his religious background, which he'd rejected, are suddenly stirred up. He hears his father's voice. He imagines that God is watching his every move. And suddenly, it's not an empty universe at all, but a just and moral one, and he's violated it. Now he's panic-stricken. He's on the verge of a mental collapse, an inch away from confessing the whole thing to the police. And then one morning he awakens and the sun is shining and his family is around him. Mysteriously, the crisis is lifted. He takes his family on a vacation to Europe, and as the months pass, he finds he's not punished. In fact, he prospers. The killing gets attributed to another person, a drifter, who has a number of other murders to his credit, so, I mean, what the hell, one more doesn't even matter. Now he's scot-free. His life is completely back to normal. Back to his protected world of wealth and privilege.
Yes, but can he ever really go back?
Well, people carry sins around with them, I mean... Oh, maybe once in a while he has a bad moment, but it passes. And with time, it all fades.
Yeah, but so then, you know, then his worst beliefs are realized.
Well, I said it was a chilling story, didn't I?
I don't know. I think it'd be tough for somebody to live with that. You know, it's very few guys could actually live, you know, live with something like that on their conscience.
I mean, people carry awful deeds around with them. And what do you expect them to do? Turn himself in? I mean, this is reality. In reality, we rationalize, we deny, or we couldn't go on living.
Here's what I would do. I would have him turn himself in, because then you see, then your story assumes tragic proportions, because in the absence of a God or something, he is forced to assume that responsibility himself. Then you have tragedy.
But that's fiction. That's movies. I mean, you see too many movies. I mean, I'm talking about reality. I mean, if you want a happy ending, you should go see a Hollywood movie.
Come on, darling. Let's think about going home, huh?
Nice talking to you. Good luck to you. Miriam, we're going to make a wedding like this with Sharon. And I can't wait. She'll be radiant.
You're looking very handsome tonight.
And you look beautiful.
What do you think of that, Doc?
Very good. That is quite a brutal reality to live with. You know, having murdered somebody and live with the guilt. Interesting. Very interesting. But the question is, are we talking about a real murder or an emotional murder? Ah.
No, he has his mistress killed.
I haven't seen the movie, though. But definitely very interesting.
What did you think of the line that Woody put in about how most of his guilt comes from a ghost of a religious past?
Well, that's true. You know, I mean, that's one of the things, you know, religion doesn't just teach us spirituality. There's always a moral component in any religious text. You know, what to do, what not to do, so on and so forth. So, I mean, that's a very truthful statement.
I mean, yeah, it's true. Most of the time when we do bad things, we feel guilty at them because we feel we have the moral obligation to feel guilty because that's what society tells us to do.
Well, you know, the thing is also what's the expiation of guilt? The expiation of guilt is forgiveness. And if you take a look from a Christian perspective, particularly the New Testament, you know, that is espoused throughout the New Testament. To treat people the way you want to be treated, to forgive people so you are forgiven. You know, in terms of this particular thing, he would have to come to a realization that he has to really be forgiven to be able to forgive himself. But many people don't see that and then rationalize as he said. It's a very, very dark little film, and I think very truthful. I think it's one of Allen's most truthful films. It's not a film that I really can get behind, you know, and I think it's because of this speech and some of the other things that happened that these people are despicable and they're going to live with that, and no one's going to think they're despicable. Because they don't think they're despicable. You know, I mean, it's a tough film. But he's absolutely fantastic in it.
But still, all the ways, Landau is never portrayed as unlikable.
No. He's sort of
and
caught.
This is the one he got his second nomination for, and he is just so great in that movie. Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course the movie that he won his award for, which is Ed Wood, I can't think of anyone else who could play Bela Lugosi.
He did it perfectly.
Well, let's look back into this. What did you think of Ed Wood?
I have not seen Ed Wood, but I saw a compilation video on YouTube of all of Martin Landau scenes as Bela Lugosi, and I really feel that Martin seriously, like, channeled Lugosi through the whole film. And I'm so happy that he got the Academy Award for that. I'm also glad Lugosi got some modern-day recognition.
And sadly, for all of the lies in Ed Wood, pretty much every speech that Bela Lugosi has, besides him cursing out Boris Karloff, is based on the truth. Like the speech of how he got addicted to drugs.
Yeah, you know, it's an amazing portrayal, and it humanizes Bela Lugosi. I mean, we think of Bela Lugosi as an icon. We don't think of him as a person. And the one thing I will say about Ed Wood, with as many problems with reality that the film has, is that they got that right. They humanized Bela, and they you really feel for him. And you also feel that the relationship between him and Ed Wood is a real relationship. And I think he just does an absolutely marvelous job in that film.
Yeah. I don't like Ed Wood, the bullcrap in it, but it's an amazing acting from Martin Landau, pretty much everybody in it.
You know, and I just got to give a shout out to Bill Murray. And that, no, Bill Murray is freaking awesome.
Well, Bill Murray was friends with Bunny when he first came to New York.
Right.
You know, I actually have to ask Bill Murray, if I ever meet Bill Murray, I got to ask him about a question about working with Stan Lee back in the Fantastic Four radio series. Anyway.
Yeah. But yeah, Landau was a great actor all around. He's done great roles.
You know, and as I said,
before we go, we got to talk about something we ignored. It was shown on Saturday morning. Yes, it was done by the guy who did Thunderbirds, and he did it really on the super cheap. But those two seasons of Space 1999 were freaking good television sci-fi.
Oh, I love Space 1999. I freaking love it. Now, I'm a huge Gerry Anderson fan, okay? I mean, I love the puppet, the marionette, Thunderball, and all those. But Gerry Anderson, when he went into sci-fi, he did a couple. He did The Day the Earth Caught Fire, too. 1970
before
it finished. But Space 1999, yeah, it was cheesy, but God, I loved it. And of course, you know, the other thing about Martin, which we really didn't talk about, is his relationship with Barbara Bain and how much that was a love story. And you could just tell that they worked together. They were together all the time until Bain's death. And it's incredibly apparent during Space 1999.
Yeah, and there's another one that we glossed over. I want to start with this story. Okay, there was this movie Arnold Schwarzenegger was filming down in Mexico,
mm-hmm.
and he was doing pre-interviews, and they said, what's this movie as a Predator about? And Arnie went, oh, have you ever seen that little movie from the 80s, a driving fleet called Without Warning? Yes, I have. Well, imagine that with a bigger budget.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so Graydon Clark, that's a shout out to you, buddy.
Yeah, I mean, that's another one where Palance and Landau worked together, and they were great in it. And ironically, the guy who played the Predator, Kevin Peter Hall, played the alien in Without Warning.
Good night.
Roll figure.
And what did you think of Without Warning and Landau in it, Doc?
I loved it. It was just, it's a fun little movie. I mean, it's one of those ones where you're just I'll give it a try, and I'm like, boom, that was awesome. So worth it. So worth it.
And
Landau's
I mentioned
good.
That, oh, everyone's good in that movie.
Go ahead.
Everyone. And it's one of those films that you put in and you just enjoy. It's you know it's not a great movie, but by
fun.
The time you're done with it, you had a great time with it.
It's more innovative than most movies would try.
Yeah.
Very true. Very true.
Like in the script, it was just your basic net, gun, pew, pew, pew thing. But Graydon was like, can't we do something innovative or something like that? And then Rick Baker said, oh, let me try something. And he bought them these bizarre little alien creatures. He's like, what? He throws them like frisbees. Oh.
And it worked. That's why I love Rick Baker.
And Landau plays a guy with combat shock in it, where it ends up turning out that he got combat shock when the first time he faced the alien.
Yep. He's wonderful in it. It's a great little movie. And again, I just want to take a shout out to Nine, which is one of my favorite animated movies. And it's a film that had a lot of hype, but people have forgotten about it. And it's the one about the little puppets that are sentient. And they have to fight these machines. And Martin Landau plays like the leader, well, not the leader of the group, but sort of like the mentor. And he dies, you know, in the midst of the film. But he has a couple of great little speeches in it. And it's just a wonderful little film. And I would recommend that film also very highly.
And I'm glad you brought up Cyclone earlier because, good Lord, him, Jeffrey Combs, it's still a great movie.
Oh, I love Cyclone. I friggin' love that movie. I saw that on HBO in the 80s and just friggin' went apeshit over that film. It's such a good little, tight little B action movie. It just is.
And it's on a great four movie set that Shout Factory put out with Exterminator 2.
Nice.
The sort of remake of Without the amazing star creature that he did called Space Huntress. You know, the one where he took like the bottoms of the giant Pepsi jars they used to have and used it like as a bra honor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that one. So.
Yeah. But, and the other two are, well, what he just said, Cyclone and Eye of the Tiger with Gary Busey.
Oh, good God. I
yeah,
forgot about that one.
Talk about getting your $7 to $9 worth.
Yeah, really. But Cyclone is the top notch movie of those. Trust me. You would agree with that, correct?
Oh yeah, it's good.
I would love to see Cyclone, so I think I'll arrange that. So I can
well,
agree
as they get to said, Exterminator 2 is fun. Space Huntress is fun. Eye of the Tiger is batshit crazy. You got Gary Busey versus William Smith as a bald biker guy. And it's the one where Gary Busey sticks up stick of dynamite up someone's tush.
All I had to say was Gary Busey, dynamite, and tush. That's all you had to say. And I'm already for it.
And yes, it comes with a plane running around machine gunning things.
Cool.
Okay, now I know how to get you excited, Doc. Gary Busey, dynamite, tush. Or maybe we should say Gary Busey's dynamite, tush.
Oh, wait a minute.
Okay, now to wrap things up, we're saying goodbye for tonight. But, Doc, I have to fucking talk to you while we're on the air.
Yes.
Why the hell was there big crates about 10 foot tall that said one had grasshoppers, one had ants, one had tarantulas, and it doesn't seem like there's that many bugs in them. So what's going on?
You've caught my little plan.
Yeah, and I got one with grasshoppers, you son of a bitch.
The upcoming show for Doc Sludge's House of Horrors is big thoughts. We're talking Deadly Mantis, Tarantula, Beginning of the End, Earth versus the Spider, the 70s movie called Bug with the Firefighting Cockroaches. Yes, we are talking about big bugs this coming show, and it's going to be great. Just don't feel.
Let's switch over to Killer Bugs so we can slip in Kingdom of the Spiders, the Giant Spider Invasion, and
okay.
Bugs.
Sounds groovy. Let's make
Wouldn't
Killer Bugs.
Wouldn't you say that'd be better, Carl?
Yeah, well, we can't do the tiny ones then, can we?
What?
We can't do the ones where they're actual regular size, right? We can't talk about it.
Yeah, that's why we're changing the title to Killer Bugs rather than just Giant.
Oh,
yes,
good. Can I talk about Phase 4?
You bet your rear end. You
yeah.
Can. It's going to be good. Yeah,
cool.
We're going to have a blast talking about Killer Bugs. And
Sunday, we're going to have our tribute to George Romero. And good God, it's going to be packed.
Tell them who's coming.
Well, so far we have confirmed Gary Clark coming back again.
Very
El
cool.
El Señor Lobo, Mr. Lobo. Troy's coming back, of course. We bring him back for everything because he's the smartest.
He's a smart fella. Not the other way
around.
Don't
forget John Amplis is going to join us.
Yeah, John Amplis, if he's not distracted by a co-ed like he usually is when he's supposed to be on this show.
Or if he forgets. Isn't there a really big guy?
I'm finished. We got, what's his name, who directed Shark Exorcist, Donald Farmer. His
Woo-hoo.
Big thing was that, you guys remember when Day of the Dead was filming, they had zombie extras? They had the press when they did the press day for all the interviews and all that. They let them be a zombie extra on the film, too?
Yep.
Very nice.
Yeah, Donald Farmer was one of those guys on the set that day.
Very, very awesome.
And we're going to have Stephen Bissett, the writer of Swamp Thing, Taboo, Tyrant, and really the guy who I love him because if you think that you're in a comic book industry and you can screw someone out of their money, no. He was one of the guys who helped found the Comic Book Defense Fund. And that's one of the laws of Magazine Publishing Comic Book Publishing, which is thou shalt not fuck with Stephen Bissett's money.
Just like thou shalt not fuck with Harlan Ellison either.
Yeah. But yeah, Stephen Bissett, we're having Mandy, one of the co-owners of the Living Dead Museum and runner of the Dead Fest, because, hey, we got to have those guys. They're more important now that it's becoming less current than history.
Yeah. And there are some nice things. I'll also report on what Pittsburgh is doing. Been a couple of things since the death, a couple of billboards that have come up, and Monroeville Mall is doing a big thing for George and his remembrance, and we'll have news on that also.
Excellent.
But yeah, it's going to be packed. We're going to have a lot of people. We're going to talk about George, and we're possibly going to have a few more, possibly maybe, but we'll keep that until they're booked.
It's going to be an epic big show.
Yeah.
And then, of course,
and
Tuesday.
And then Tuesday, we'll be finishing up 1977.
Right, and we'll finish up 1977. And
this
we'll
time,
go on
I
from
promise
there.
You, Carl, will be talking about how much he loves ABBA the movie.
Oh, good God. No, we won't. We'll be talking about how much
love
ABBA. No, it's you love it.
No, how
ABBA.
Much you love ABBA. You're the host of the show.
No, you love ABBA. I fucking hate ABBA. It's only because you're producing, you're making me love ABBA. It's like you shot me in a goddamn leather teddy and says, bow down, mother.
Did somebody say ABBA? She's a dancing
yes.
queen.
Shut the fuck up.
Oh, this is classic. Deep breath.
And with that, well, to sum it up, well, this is for me. I'll let everybody else sum it up. Martin Landau was great in the 70s and 80s, but good God, did he have an amazing run from Tucker on as just a character actor.
Did actually fabulous work. Three movies in a row, he was up for an Academy Award.
In the 90s,
awesome.
It was rare to see a winner that everyone wasn't going like, bull crap, this is bull crap. And there was a lot of fighting in the 90s about which actor should have won each year, except for him.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Time I was fighting with Carl, and it was like, bullshit, Samuel L. Jackson should have won for Best Supporting. Martin Landau won for Ed Wood. Okay.
Never mind.
Yeah, and what's your summation of about his work, Doc?
Well, his work is quite impressive. I mean, I have not seen a lot of his films. I've seen a couple episodes of Space 1999. You know, I've seen Without Warning, and I've seen the parts of Ed Wood. And you know, just talking about him and actually hearing some of his scenes makes me want to really invest my time in seeing the movies that he was in. Definitely. And I was actually talking to Steve earlier tonight, and I said, you know, I always used to get Frank Langella and Martin Landau confused for some bizarre reason, what movies they were in and who they were. But that has cleared up over the years, which I'm glad.
Yeah.
So,
well, me and Carl have a tougher one. Carl agree.
Okay.
Sometimes it's easy to get Rip Torn and Martin Landau confused.
Yeah,
really?
That's true. That's true. But for me, to be very honest, and it's something I should at least bring out once, you know, I'm older than both of you. So when the 60s were around and Mission Impossible was so big, we all would watch that. I mean, he was part of my childhood. I was like, 66? I was 8 years old, and I was watching Martin Landau. So I saw him, you know, from the beginning of what I can remember, basically. And then to see him, and this is what I was trying to express with Tucker, to see him do Tucker and just see how really good he was just an amazing fact of life. And it was a confirmation that I've liked him all this time. I liked him through that tough 80s period, where he was doing, you know, smaller films than that. The man really had longevity, and it was that longevity that made him the actor that we remember in the 90s. But don't forget, it's longevity. He went through ups and downs like crazy, and he prevailed, and we love him for it.
Yeah. And really, don't forget that Space 1999 was the fix that Star Trek junkies ran to after that show was canceled, and they really hadn't really geared up showing the reruns on TV yet.
That's true. That and the original Battlestar, too, was another one about the same time.
Yeah. Okay, we'll see you on tomorrow for the Killer Bugs episode.
Yeah.
Thank you for Jack's shoulder coming on tonight.
Absolutely. Thank you very,
awesome
very
hearing him.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Jack, for showing up. We really, really appreciate and appreciate your work.
And thank
and
you,
your
the doctor,
story.
Showing up at the last minute. Me and Carl knew we were going to do it, but we didn't know you were going to show up. Thank you.
Yay,
well,
Doc!
Well, let's put it this way. I need, after the day I had today, with a strong conductor blowing out my network, getting sent home from work, and falling asleep, everything turned out really, really good. So I'm glad to have joined you guys. I'm very happy I did. So there. Big smile. Big smile.
And thank you to everyone who's listening to this. And most of all, thank you, Martin Landau, for all your great performances.
Absolutely.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night. Word, you do it. There
Come
is
on,
trouble
Steven.
Because the producer is an idiot. The producer,
the
is,
producer is
an
idiot.
It's not going well.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Open the circuit to the wave motion gun. Open the circuit.
Gun receiver pressure increases. It's at full.
All the ship's energy is now in the wave motion gun.
I doubt anyone here would recognize civic virtue if it reached up and bit you in the ass.
Oh, did I hurt your feelings?
Well, the Magneto's right. There's a war coming.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
You sure you're on the right side?